Studio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio in this segment. Mr. Jim DiEugenio from Los Angeles. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Len.
Thank you so much for making time again. We usually talk about what's new at your website, Kennedy's and King, and then anything that is in the news. And there has been a few things in the news with the Luna, you know, Trump opening up some of the documents and people going through them. So tell me what is new in Los Angeles.
Well, first of all, at the website Kennedy's and King, you're going to see part one of a three-part interview that me and Oliver Stone did with Katie Halper. Katie Halper used to be on Rising, the part of the Hill Network out of Washington, and she apparently saw the committee hearing with me, Oliver, and Jeff Morley in Washington, and so she wanted to talk to me and Oliver about that. This is only part one that's up there now. There's going to be a part two, and then there's going to be a part three. And the part three is only me talking about the King case. So I have to say she was very well informed. And that really doesn't happen a heck of a lot, because she's pretty much of a, she's a pretty big name in the talk podcast type of world. She does one with Aaron Maté, Useful Idiots, and then she does her own show. I think she got fired from Rising because of her controversial comments about Israel and Gaza. So she does her own show now. And I was very glad with the way this thing turned out. So I really recommend that people tune in on this one and come back for the part two and part three. Now, the other new article that I have up there is entitled The Nothing Burgers. Nope. All right. And this one, I put this up at Twitter, okay, now called X. This article got 73,000 impressions on the first day. I haven't been back to see what it's up to now, okay, but it's probably much more. And so I was really sick and tired of all the MSM BS about there's not anything new coming out of the executive order by Trump files, okay? The New York Times, for example, did this. So I just at random, you know, decided, and I've talked about this on your show, but I decided to put this in this article. And apparently a lot of people were looking for this stuff because that's why it's become so popular on Twitter. So I'm not going to go through all this stuff before because I like I said, I've done it.
Right. But, you know, the other side of the coin was other mainstream media were bringing out, again, Posner to say there's nothing there.
I know. Isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah. So that's why.
Does anybody really think that Gerald Posner is going to put his face into those memos, you know, and read all them? And then if there's anything new, tell the public about it? No. No. All right.
Well, I mean, but, you know,
but there
better,
is but. Some there is some new stuff in there. And so this is what I was trying, you know, to bring to the public's attention. All right. There's stuff in there about Mexico City. There's stuff in there about Oswald's 201 file. All right. There's stuff in there about Castro attempting, you know, a reconstruction of what the Warren Commission did and not, it's not working. All right. There's stuff in there about David Slauson trying to figure out what Oswald was up to in Helsinki. Now, let's just take that last one. All right. Why is this important? First of all, the Warren Commission doesn't really make a lot out of Oswald's visit to Helsinki. So let me set it up. All right. When Oswald left the Marines, he got what's called a hardship discharge. What does that mean? That means you request an early dismissal on some kinds of grounds that somebody in your family is undergoing some kind of medical emergency and they need your help. Or they don't have any money and they need you to go back there and work or whatever. Oswald got this hardship discharge. And according to House Select Committee on Assassinations, this usually takes 3 to 6 months. Oswald's went through in 11 days. That's step number one that makes it suspicious. It was 9 months before he was supposed to be officially discharged. Well, the other thing is, there doesn't seem to have been any real investigation of the circumstances. How could there be in 11 days? You know, that's why it takes 3 to 6 months, because the Marines go ahead and investigate what the real circumstances are. That's number two. When Oswald did get dismissed, he was only in Dallas-Fort Worth for 72 hours. That's it. All right. And the excuse was that Marguerite, his mother, had at work, she was working in some mall at a candy stand, that she had a box fall on her nose. One of the doctors she went to see, she told him that her son would be getting dismissed from the service early. Now, how much more fishy do you want this to be? All right. So, obviously, there was no investigation at all, period. Or they wouldn't have granted it. And so, Oswald comes back for 72 hours. Then he leaves for the Soviet Union. This, of course, is after he was trying to learn Russian in the Marine Corps. And according to Roslyn Quinn, who went out with him a couple of times, he did a very good job because she said he was more fluent in Russian than she was. And she had been studying it for over a year with a tutor. So now this has all the earmarks, of course, now of being a setup. All right. But here is, let's get to the payoff. All right. Oswald leaves from New Orleans, the same travel agency the International Trademark used. I'm not going to make anything of that. It might have just been a coincidence. Then he goes across the Atlantic, and he's like a cheap passenger on a freighter. He then goes from England to France to Helsinki. Now, why is his going to Helsinki important? And why should this have been ringing a lot of emergency bells? And apparently it did, because Slauson was very interested in it when he was working for the Warren Commission. Well, there's two reasons. It's very interesting. Oswald stayed at the Hotel Tourney. Ian Griggs, the late British researcher, told me he had gone to the Hotel Tourney. He said, Jim, the Hotel Tourney is a 4-star hotel. So here we have a guy who's trying to save money by traveling on a freighter across the Atlantic. But when he gets to Helsinki, he stays at a 4-star hotel. All right. Now, after one day, he checked out of the Hotel Tourney, and he went to something called the Klaus Kirke. Well, Ian went to that one also. And he said, Jim, if the Hotel Tourney was a 4-star hotel, the second hotel he stayed at was like a 3.5-star. Now, this is very interesting in and of itself, because here we have these $200, $300 hotels that Oswald is staying in, and he's not supposed to have any money. He's only supposed to have like $300 to his name, and he's not even in Russia yet. But the second thing that's so important about Helsinki is that it was the only European capital where you could get the fastest visas possible. You can get them as easily as 48 hours. You get a visa into the Soviet Union. Now, the obvious question that Slauson was apparently trying to dodge is how in God's name did Oswald know this? How did he know that Helsinki was the one place in Europe that you didn't have to wait for a week to get a visa, okay, or 7 or 8 days? Well, these are all the things that the Warren Commission tried to avoid, all right? You go from step one to step five here, and every step along the way appears to be a setup that Oswald's was a planned fake defection, down to the fact that he was told where to go, all right, in order to get quickly into the Soviet Union, all right? And somehow, some way, on his Motel 6 budget, he ends up at a 4-star hotel in Helsinki. Incredible. But the interesting thing about it is that Slauson was poking around in this, all right? He wanted to know what Oswald did while he was in Helsinki. He wanted to know where he went. He wanted to know where he stayed at. And he was asking these questions. So it's very hard to believe that he didn't at least suspect something was up. Now, here's the problem, of course. The problem, of course, is that the Warren Commission relied on the FBI and the CIA, you know, for their information. Now, in a situation like this, I imagine, because it's an international thing, that they relied upon the CIA for their information. Now, if in retrospect, of course, for Slauson to have trusted these guys is really nutty. Of course, we can chalk this up to naivete, all right, because back then in 1964, I don't think very many people had any suspicions about how bad the CIA really was. All right. Now, there were some questions, of course, about the assassination itself, because you had these early people like Mark Lane and Stoughton Lind, all right, in the New Republic, all right. You had Joachim Jostein, et cetera. You had some early pioneers in 1963-64 who did have some suspicions, but nobody was going to go as far as to actually point out who was responsible at that time. All right, so we can excuse that part. But I really don't think you can excuse the fact that Slauson and whoever worked with him on this decided to try and write the whole thing off, when in fact it reeks to high heaven when you put everything together, all right? And in my opinion, what Slauson should have been doing was working backwards. He had these suspicions about Helsinki, you know? Why on earth did Oswald go there? What was he doing while he was there? How did he get around while he was there? These are the kind of questions he was asking. So if you just do what some investigators do, if you work backward from the point of interest, all right, then, you know, usually that will result in something, all right? Well, evidently, you know, Slauson, well, let's put it this way. You know, the Warren Commission was such a setup that I can imagine, you know, these guys got the Riot Act read to them very early in the game. And so Slauson was simply not going to do anything about this very curious, you know, visit by Oswald to Helsinki. All right. Now, the other thing, I don't know if I mentioned this before, is that apparently there was a debate in the CIA about whether or not Kostikov was really Department 13. That's very interesting, because one of the things I managed to go through, and again, this was not in any way a comprehensive or categorical review of these 77,000 pages. I went through maybe a few hundred of them to come up with this list. But a memo in 1971 from the CIA said that they didn't have any information that Kostikov was part of Department 13. Now, what that means, of course, that is the implication being that did the CIA put out false info around the day of the assassination, saying that A, Oswald had met with Kostikov in Mexico City, and B, Kostikov was part of Department 13, which did liquidations in the Western Hemisphere. Now, anybody who listens to this show will understand that I have some very serious questions about Oswald being in Mexico City. A, all right, okay. There's all kinds of problems, and all you have to do is read the Lopez report. If Oswald was in Mexico City, why is there no picture of him going in or out of either embassy? There should have been 10 of them. Let me repeat that. There should have been 10 of them. There should have been 10 pictures of Oswald going into either the Cuban or the Russian consulate, or whatever you want to call it. The consulate is connected to the embassy. It's right in the back of it. All right. Secondly, why has the CIA never been able to produce a tape of Oswald's voice? If you remember, the night of the assassination, the CIA sent what they said was a tape of Oswald's voice to the FBI, who were interrogating, part of the interrogation of Oswald in Dallas. All right. J. Edgar Hoover wrote a memo saying that my agents who are interrogating Oswald have listened to this tape. And this is not Oswald. All right. Now, David Phillips, who I, along with John Newman, believe was in this up to his neck. All right. David Phillips tried to put out a cover story that all the tapes had been destroyed. That's what he tried to say. But if you read the Lopez report, they write in there that if a person of interest was at either embassy, they would not destroy the tape in the usual 7 to 8 days. They would send it up to headquarters. Now, how can you be of more interest in a Russian defector? All right? This is one of the things, like, I don't know how many people, I don't know if I've said this before, okay, but Danny Hardway, who has been on your show, okay, and Eddie Lopez, who wrote, these two guys wrote the Lopez report, all right, they wrote up bills of indictment for both Phillips and Ann Goodpasture. All right. David Phillips and Ann Goodpasture. Ann Goodpasture was Winston Scott's executive assistant. Now, according to Eddie Lopez, who I've talked to more than once, he told me that when Phillips was not there, and he was not there a lot because he'd be flying around to JM Wave and to Langley, Goodpasture took care of his operations when he wasn't there. They caught Phillips and Goodpasture in so many lies. I mean, if you just read the Lopez report, and if you haven't read it, I strongly recommend you do, all right, because it's definitely worth the 300 pages. All right. You will see them catch these guys in lie after lie after lie. All right? So if these are the two people who put together this papier-mâché story that has so many problems with it about Oswald being in Mexico City, all right, were they in on this whole thing about Kostikov? You know, I can't help but wonder, you know. I mean, Ann Goodpasture, to use just one example, Danny and Eddie were trying to get to the bottom of who is the first person that would go into the tape center and the photograph center and pick up the previous day's coverage. Because they thought that, and it is, it's important. Who was the first person who would do that the next day? And Ann Goodpasture said she wasn't sure. This set them off on a wild goose chase. So they're trying to find, okay, is it this person? Is it this? And they start interviewing these people. And finally, after about four people, they went through about four different people. And the guy says, wait a minute. Why are you asking me? Ann Goodpasture was the first person who had access to that thing. And she did it at David Phillips' request. So the question then becomes, and this is what Danny and Eddie were onto, why did Ann Goodpasture lie about this? All right? What was so important that she had to lie about this? And one of the reasons they believe she lied is because she sent up the picture of the man in Mexico picture, okay, which is obviously not Oswald, all right? And she actually, not only did she lie about that not being Oswald, she lied about on what day the picture was taken. Because, according to Danny and Eddie, she moved it over so that there would be no question as Oswald was still in Mexico City at the time. When in fact, on the day that it was really taken, Oswald left that afternoon. So there could be a debate on whether or not she knew this was Oswald or not. Okay. You know, because it was supposedly the description was a Caucasian fellow. Okay. Coming out of the Cuban consulate or something like that. So here comes the question, you know, why was it so important for Ann Goodpasture to do all this skullduggery? And the next question, of course, is was she doing it in David Phillips's service? All right. This is a very, very interesting question, which we never knew about until 1995, because the CIA did not want to let go of the Lopez report. And I think I talked about this because I asked Eddie. I said, Eddie, why wasn't that report in the House Select Committee volumes? And he said, Jim, the day we went in to meet with the CIA team about the report, putting it in the volumes, they objected to every single sentence in the first two pages of the report. It took us 8 hours to get through the first two pages. And so Blakey threw in the towel. Okay. Now, if you've read the Lopez report, and again, I recommend everybody listening to this show, read it if you haven't, you will understand why the CIA was so on fire about those first two pages. Because the early part of the Lopez report deals with the camera coverage over the embassies. What they didn't want anybody to know is that one of the cameras outside the Cuban consulate was something called a pulse camera. This was generations ahead of its time. Okay. It was activated by the air current of the door opening and closing of the Cuban consulate. So the obvious question would be, you had a camera that sensitive and it missed Oswald six times? Huh? Are you bleeping serious? Okay, how the heck did that happen? So then what they tried to say, this was David Phillips' excuse, that the camera was out that day. But Danny and Eddie checked, and no, it wasn't. Okay? All right? This is why the CIA did not want that report as part of the House Select Committee volumes. It was that bad. Now, if you would have had that in 1978, 1979, we wouldn't have to wait for all this great stuff about Mexico City 15 years later. All right, we would have had it at the time. And then if you add in how the House Select Committee screwed up the autopsy evidence, you know, that's one of the things I talked about in Washington, of course. You know, was this whole BS story about the witnesses at Bethesda not seeing this blasted out hole in the back of Kennedy's head like the people at Parkland did. Well, that was wrong. Well, to say it was wrong is being nice. You know, I think it was a deception. And then when you add it up, of course, when Gary Aguilar tried to confront Bodden, Blakey, and Andy Purdy. Andy Purdy was a chief medical investigator. None of them wanted to take the responsibility for writing it. Well, who did then? You know? Oh, and I have to say, was Andy Purdy on your show lately?
No. I'm not sure I've ever had him on.
Okay, because I think he was on another show. Somebody interviewed him, and he said he read the JFK assassination chokeholds twice or something like that. Okay, so I guess we're making a little bit of headway with that book, you know, if Andy Purdy's reading it, you know. But anyway, to get back to my original point, was the whole Mexico City thing a charade? That is a really very important question, you know. And if so, was this whole thing about Kostikov? Was it the capper to this charade about Oswald? Okay, because the obvious implication would be back on November 22nd, 1963, did Oswald do what he did at the request of Kostikov? In other words, were the Russians behind it? Now, what makes that so interesting is, of course, Richard K. Snegle. Because if you remember from Dick Russell's book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Snegle was hired by the KGB because they had heard in the wind that there was a plot to kill Kennedy. And they quite naturally thought that they're going to blame this on us. So they hired Snegle to find out if there was a plot, and if there was, if he could stop it. All right? So this all falls together, you know, like pieces of a puzzle. You know, this whole thing about A, Oswald and supposedly in Mexico City, B, Oswald supposedly meeting with Kostikov, and C, the KGB understanding this in advance. All right. So that's another really, really interesting part of these new files. This whole thing about Kostikov and Mexico City. And of course, as I said earlier, there's no known picture of Oswald going in or coming out of the Russian embassy. And there's no known tape of Oswald at the Russian embassy.
And like you'd mentioned before, I mean, if there was a tape, they would be waving it. They'd be playing it, you know?
Yes. Yes, it would have been. So why did Phillips lie about the tapes being destroyed, number one? And why did Angleton fly down to Mexico City when he heard Winston Scott had passed away? And why did he threaten his wife with cutting off her retirement benefits if she did not give him access to Winston Scott's safe? Okay? These are all very, very, very suspicious matters, I believe. You know, they, to me, because, you know, this is 7 weeks in advance of the assassination, you know. And did somebody arrange for all this, you know? Did Phillips do it? Was Ann Goodpasture in on it? All right.
Well, she's sure hiding something, you know.
Boy, you're not kidding. And by the way, if you saw the last talk that Danny and Eddie did, this was for the ARC conference in 2014. If you've ever seen that, and if I were you, Len, I would actually put it on your show. If you can get permission from, what is it, Alan Dale? He does all that stuff for the ARC. I would make it an installment on your show. They said, now I'm not, don't quote me verbatim on this, but they said words of the effect that they really didn't suspect anything about Mexico City until they met Ann Goodpasture.
Yeah, right.
That's what Danny said. Then we met Ann Goodpasture, and everything now began to get very, very suspicious, you know? All right?
Well, Dan Hardway is on one of the 50 Reasons for 50 Years.
Right, right.
Right, and it's one of the longer ones. They were all roughly, you know, 5 minutes each kind of thing, right?
Right.
But
you held me to 7 minutes.
Yeah, oh, well, and whoever, right? But he was quite specific. He said, look, I don't want things to get mixed up, so I'm going to write out what I'm going to say. I'm going to send it to you. And I think it took 10 minutes, I'll say, right?
And I think it was longer than
yeah,
that.
11 maybe. But yeah. But regardless, the point was
that, no, it was worth it.
Yeah, and he just – so I said, there's no problem. I'm 100% – so – he spelled it out. People should go back. I could make a link to that 50 mm-hmm. Episode. I'm not sure what it is. 44? But, yeah. So that was the thing, you know. He was very specific. A lot of people just off the cuff, they spoke to me over the phone like we're doing now and that. But he had written out. And he sent it to me, and I go, look, this is what I'm going to say, and I want to make sure that you don't cut anything out, you just put it like that. And I said, no problem, you know, that's the whole idea. And the fact that you've taken time to prepare your presentation and you've written it out, that's hats off, you know.
That was 2013, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a year before he did his ARC presentation. Yeah. See, him and Eddie, they, as time has gone on, they have not liked to appear in public for whatever reason. So that time on your show and that time at the ARC, I believe those are the last two times Danny ever said anything about their service. Well, and the other thing, of course, that's important about Danny and Eddie, they tried to blow the whistle on Joannides, all right? They said, you know, when Joannides came in, everything changed. You know, they were actually, I don't know if I've ever said this before, but they were working out of CIA headquarters. Let me say that again. They were working out of CIA headquarters. And they would be there in the reading room, and they would request files. All right? And they would get them. And they would get them in a short period of time, unredacted. So when Joannides came in, this all changed. Now they were moved out of Langley, and they had a special room at the House Select Committee building, and there was now a safe, and there was another safe inside the safe, and they had a CIA liaison checking in and checking out. In other words, they would have to make a request, and then they would have to wait for the CIA to bring it down, and this was Joe Anita's, all right? And not only did they have to check in and check everything out, they had to turn in their notes at the end of the day. So that on top of all this was the fact that now Joannides slowed everything down. They weren't getting stuff the same day they requested it. And on top of that, there were now redactions in the documents. And they tried to complain to Blakey about this. Their complaint was ineffective. And this is one of the reasons that Blakey now cries mea culpa about Joannides. Okay? He was warned at the time what was happening, you know, by...
Yeah, and he didn't believe it. And he just said, oh, why would they lie to me? Something to that effect?
Oh, please. I don't even want to talk about that.
Yeah,
okay?
I know.
It's kind of a painful subject.
Yeah.
All right? But this is what happened. See, this is what... See, Danny and Eddie, they had not just Mexico City, but it was also the CIA, all right? And then this was supplemented by Betsy Wolf. Betsy Wolf was doing analysis of the Oswald file. And I've talked about that more than once, all right? But if you were to put all this together, if you were to put all this together, the combination of Joannides, all the problems with Oswald in Mexico City, and all the problems with Oswald's 201 file, if all that would have been in the volumes, I think it would have made a pretty big impact myself, all right? But to be perfectly frank, we didn't get any of that at the time. Nothing, all right? The House Select Committee closed down at the end of 1978, and I believe, if I'm remembering this correctly, there was only, everybody was let go, all right? And there was only a skeleton crew. From what I've been told, there's like four people, and two of them being Blakey and Billings. And they're the ones who, those four people are the ones who wrote the report. And they, of course, they're also the ones who decided what was going to go into the volumes.
And what would be locked up?
Well, that was going to be my next.
Sorry,
yeah.
Okay.
What was going to go in the volumes and what was not going to go in the volumes? And what was not going to go into volumes, of course, was going to be classified till 2029. And thank God Oliver Stone did that crawler at the end of his film, alerting the public that the files of the House Select Committee are going to be classified until 2029. Now, this was in 1991. So if not for his film, we would have had to wait 3 decades. Thank God we didn't, and thank God one of the first things ARB declassified was the Lopez report. And then we had Doug Horn and Jeremy Gunn doing the review of the autopsy. And then we had Malcolm Blunt sending me the handwritten files of Betsy Wolf. And that's how we finally found out about this stuff. Okay, that's how we finally found out about this. Thank God for the ARB, you know? Or this stuff would have gone missing for a long, 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 long time, you know? So that's just some of the things, if you read the article, it's just some of the things that these new declassified files are relevant to. So this whole thing about the New York Times and the MSM saying there's nothing in these, no, that's simply not. If there's only nothing there if A, you don't want there to be anything there, and B, if you don't know anything about this case. If you know anything about the case, just going through a couple of hundred of these files will reveal some very interesting stuff. All right? Okay. All right, Len.
All right.
Okay. Thanks for having me on.
Right. And also, is there any couple of new things that are going up at Kennedy's and King?
Oh, yes. There's Jeff Meek is doing an article. I think you might have him on this week or next, about the lawsuit that Gail Nick Jackson is filing against the Sixth Floor. Okay, that's very interesting stuff.
Anything right. against the Sixth Floor, I love it.
And I'm going to review Mr. Abbott's book about the murder of Oswald. I'm working on that now. Okay. And you had him on, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. This is the guy who went through the Garrison files and put an index together. All right. Also, John Avery Emison did a revised and expanded version of his book. Did you know that? You had him on about his Martin Luther King book, which I think is the best book on the King case I've ever read. Well, he did an updated and revised version. So you should have him on again.
Update? Okay, sure.
And I'm telling you, I've only read about the first 50 pages, but it's better than the first version. Okay? All right. Now, Lisa is working on an article about the new RFK files. All right? And Andrew Eiler is going to be doing a long two-part review about his discoveries about the ARB, what he's discovered in some of their email messages and communications. And Johnny Cairns is going to be doing the third part to his review of the Boylan Hancock book. So those are some things to look forward to. All right?
All right. Very good. All right.
Okay, Len.
Yep. Thank you very much again. We'll keep in touch.
Okay, you're welcome. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we're speaking to author-researcher Mr. Jeffrey Meek. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Len. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for taking Great. Time today.
You're welcome.
Gail Nix Jackson Family Sues the Sixth Floor. This is the title of a new article up at Kennedy's and King, and I urge people to go there to read it. But for those who are interested, I just wanted to have you on to just to discuss it and give us an overview of what's going on there, and then we'll make links to the Kennedy's and King article.
Yeah, I had been in touch with Gail. Let's see, it was at last November's Lancer. And we kind of hit it off and have emailed back and forth some and, you know, was aware of the previous lawsuit. And, you know, I just let her know I'd be glad to help pursue this and get the word out. And at that time, you know, they weren't really talking about any of that first lawsuit. And when this one came about, she contacted me and let me know about it. And basically, they are suing the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, basically on about conflict of interest. And Gail put me in touch with the family's lead attorney, Leland C. De La Garza, and he sent me an email, and I'll read what it says if you want me to.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, quoting, "The lawsuit seeks to rescind the agreement between Nix and the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza and legally require the Sixth Floor Museum to return the copyright to the Nix film and the physical copies of the Nix film based on wrongdoings only recently uncovered. Plaintiffs contend in the lawsuit were committed by the Sixth Floor Museum and Mr. James Silverberg during the negotiation of the agreement. The basis for the lawsuit is set out in the petition filed in District Court in Dallas. We are confident in our legal position and that the court will correct the wrong that was done to Mr. Nix by the Sixth Floor Museum and Mr. Silverberg." And the article goes on to explain that Mr. Silverberg, while representing the Nix family, was also representing the Sixth Floor Museum. And the petition, which was filed earlier this month, has five counts. Count one is fraud by misrepresentation, saying that the defendants fraudulently induced the Nix family to enter into the Nix film agreement by making a misrepresentation of a material fact. The defendants represented to the Nix family that Silverberg represented them, and this representation was false because Silverberg represented both the Nix family and the Sixth Floor Museum at the same time. Count two is fraud by non-disclosure, saying that Silverberg, you know, didn't let the Nix family know about this. Count three is a breach of fiduciary duties, which, according to Mr. De La Garza, the elite attorney, is a requirement by a lawyer to his client, and that he's not doing that. The fourth count is knowing participation in breaches of fiduciary duties, and the fifth count is aiding and abetting breaches of fiduciary duties. And all this was filed on April 3rd, and Mr. De La Garza feels like they have a very good basis for the lawsuit, and so we'll see where it goes. I also noticed when I was reading through it that I didn't know that on a couple of occasions the Nixes tried to buy back the Nix film and the Nix film property, actually. But that was rejected. They tried to do that in May of 2021 and again in December of 2024, but their offers have been rejected by the Sixth Floor Museum. So we'll see where this goes. In talking to Gail, I think I can say that she's hopeful. She really feels, you know, that, as it says, that there was some wrongdoing here, and it would certainly seem to me, and I am certainly not a lawyer, that there is a conflict of interest there. I don't think it's proper, let alone legal, to represent both sides in a negotiation.
Well, the Sixth Floor Museum itself is known just to be, I'm pretty prejudiced in my views of it, so I'll try to be light on it. But for the years of Gary Mack and the people who even started the museum and keep the funding for it, and it's just a fraud, a sham of a museum. It's a one-sided propaganda center.
It certainly is one-sided, yeah. They could add several more displays of the other side of the fence, that's for sure.
Or, you know, just try to go down the middle. Some people say there was, you know, and other people say that, and we're still not clear, but maybe the record, instead of just, you know, having the Gerald Posner, the outright fraudsters of the case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And Gary Mack was one of the biggest ones, you know.
Yeah. Well, the petition is, I would say, somewhat lengthy. It's 70 pages, and the family is requesting a trial by jury. And I'm unaware of any response to the petition at this time, but when I let Jimmy DeGenio know about it, he said, why don't you write about it? And so I did, and it, I guess it posted today. So I don't think the word was out much. I hadn't heard anybody else talking about it, and so I kind of nosed around, just sent out just a little blurb on what I knew. And
good. Well, I'm glad that you brought it to Jim's attention, and he brought it to my attention, and now listeners of Black Op Radio can just be up to date on what's going on and also read about it.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell people, maybe unaware of, what the importance of the original Nix film would be?
Well, and I touch on this in the article, you know, that it was, for those who don't know, Orville Nix Sr. filmed the assassination as the presidential motorcade was, and the presidential limousine was going down Elm Street. And he's farther away from the limousine from Abraham Zapruder. He's on the opposite side of the street. But as he pans down Elm Street, as the presidential limousine is proceeding down Elm Street, it shows the grassy knoll and the picket fence. And so obtaining and being able to see the original is important to see what might be able to be seen there. And that's part of their first lawsuit, that, you know, nobody can seem to find it. Let's put it that way. So the film is extremely important for what it might show. You know, as you know, and many of your listeners know, the House Select Committee on Assassinations felt it by a 95% or better, I might add, or better chance of a shot from the front. And perhaps the original Knicks film could shed some light on that. So it's important to find it and see it and make it public.
Yeah, exactly. And also for comparisons for people who are saying that something's been cropped out, something's edited, there's been alteration, get the original films and compare them.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah.
So, we know that even a first-generation print loses some clarity. So, finding and, taking a close look at that original, I think, is really important. And, Robert Groden is still with us, and it would be great if it were available so he and others that have the expertise that he has could take a look and see if we could see something. Because there was a shot from the front. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
Right, and those of us who are interested are just looking into it further. But the obfuscation and the deceit, I think, of government and any agency and like the Sixth Floor have not made an honest effort to reveal what really happened. Uncomfortable as it may be, what really happened. And they just continue. At least Trump has made the effort to start declassification and public release, right?
Yes, yeah.
So, I don't know, do you have any opinion on what's been released so far?
I get asked that question a lot by, friends and family and other researchers, and it's, close to 80,000 pages. I've maybe been through
right.
800.
I haven't gone through hardly anything. I'm waiting for other people to...
So, what I tell people is, there's no smoking gun going to be in there. There never has been, in my opinion, there has been a smoking gun document and never will be. They're not that stupid to say, Len, you go behind the picket fence and Jeff, you go up to the fourth floor of the museum or whatever, the Texas School Book Depository. And, that doesn't exist. But what has been shown, and Jefferson Morley has done a good job of going over this, is, seeing a pattern of what many of us have believed for a long time, that Lee Harvey Oswald was all over CIA's radar for a number of years. He wasn't just some name that popped up, a blip on their screen on November 22nd, 1963. I've also seen a document about inquiries into how did Oswald get to Helsinki so quick? Which has been another thing that I think Chad Nagel wrote about, if I remember right, within the last year. So again, I've read probably 1% of what's out there, but I just think there's some interesting asides. Nothing that is a bombshell.
Right, but if you were to flip it to the other side of the coin, every release does not back anything to do with Lee Oswald was a lone gunman. He had intelligence help. He was this, that. At the end of the day, if you subscribe to what he said, I'm just a patsy, go backwards with that. He was asked to do this. He was asked to defect. He was this. He was on duty. Where's there's so many.
Yeah, how did he get the money to travel?
Right. How was he greeted back? Right. What was that guy's name?
Yeah.
Rakin. Bass Rakin met him back. The whole thing just has the fingerprints of the intelligence community. And then if you're looking further, you say, who would have ordered that? Who wanted him? And those kind of people are, the Allen Dulleses, the Sullivan Cromwell, the big banking concerns behind maybe Kennedy pulling out of Vietnam, Kennedy not going into bomb Cuba add those up.
And the prospect of, a decade of Kennedys in the White House, too, I think is a factor. Len, about Oswald and intelligence agencies, many years ago, I think it was 1976 or 77, I don't remember how I found this person, but I did an interview with Ron Crawley. And as you know, there's maybe 1,000 books on the Kennedy assassination. And I saw him listed in Harvey and Lee, just a list of people that was in the Marine Corps with Oswald. And then he's also mentioned in the missing chapter Lee Harvey Oswald in the Far East. But what's not in any either of those two books or any of the other books is what I learned from Crawley when I asked him about Oswald and any special assignments. And I asked Crawley, I said, were you ever offered any special assignments? And he said, I can't talk about that. He said that at Tsugi Naval Air Station is what I'm talking about. While he was there as a radar operator with Lee Harvey Oswald in his unit. And he said the CIA was all over that base. He couldn't talk about him being approached for an intelligence assignment. But about Oswald, he said he would leave the base for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And when he said at a time, to me, I interpreted that, rightly or wrongly, as more than once. So how do you leave a Marine Corps base for 2 or 3 weeks at a time and come back and not be in trouble? You don't.
Yeah.
I mean,
like he's on assignment.
If you're AWOL, absent without leave, that'd be in your record, wouldn't it? And there's no such thing in Oswald's record. So that's when I believe, and why I believe, Lee Harvey Oswald was recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency while he was in the Marine Corps in Japan.
Right. And so, as we're saying, is when people, researchers, concerned citizens, are looking over these 80,000 documents, they're finding the intelligence community, all the different cryptonyms for people's names that are maybe being released, and you know, we're just learning more and more about what was going on in that era.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that Schlesinger memo that's out, I can't remember the RIF number right now, but, you know, that shows a serious discussion on reorganization of the Central Intelligence Agency and parts of that. And I think it's page 8 that was entirely redacted at one point. I haven't read through the whole thing, but just peeking at it here and there, you know, obviously Kennedy was really concerned about a runaway Central Intelligence Agency. And he didn't trust them, and the military didn't trust him, and the CIA didn't trust Kennedy. And I think that's what resulted in his assassination.
Yeah.
And, you know, a friend pointed out, you know, about the level of hatred for Kennedy by some in authority. And, you know, they pointed this out, and I thought, yeah, you know, you're right. There's so much hatred against our current president and 2 assassination attempts, and let's just hope it doesn't happen again.
Right, and I think the thing that has interested me and maybe other researchers is that with Kennedy, people really thought he was the last good president acting on behalf of what was good for America and then good for the world as well.
Yeah,
and then...
Well, he was a president that sought peace, world peace, you know, not militaristic. He was, you know, anti-imperialist. He had some wonderful speeches that he did in the 1950s as a senator. And, you know, just everywhere you look, Kennedy was on an opposite plane that his military was. And, you know, as you know, 7 Days in May, the book and the movie, Kennedy really saw that as the situation he was in. And I've also read that on the plane ride back to Dallas, back to Washington, D.C., LBJ's assistant, I think it was Bill Moyers at the time, LBJ made a comment about something like, I wonder if the missiles are flying. And so even the vice president wondered about who's in charge of the country right now.
Okay, well, thanks for writing about this, and we'll have to keep on top of that and maybe even talk to Gail as it gets closer to that. Anything else that you're working on that you want to help promote right now?
Well, you know, I'm just slowly rating through these documents. I will add that my latest book, The JFK Files, Pieces of the Assassination Puzzle, Volume 2, is now available on Amazon. And I've got interviews in there with people like Antoinette Giancana, Sam Giancana's daughter, Tim Cheek, who was a JFK pallbearer, had some interesting things to say. I also included an interview I did many years ago with Russell W. McLarry, who weeks after Oswald was dead was arrested as a suspect. They tried to tie him into Oswald. I've got an interview in there with Officer L.L. Hill, who within hours or minutes or hours of the assassination was sent over by Cobb Stadium to check out a suspect's vehicle. I've got an interview in there with Bert Griffin. Janet Bannister talks about what her family has said over the years about Guy Bannister. I've got an interview in there with Jimmy D about one of Kennedy's very famous speeches. And I think you know that I also write for George Magazine, and been with them now for about a year. And I did a lengthy three-part series on Gayton Fonzie. And, you know, people who have followed this know that name and are probably aware of his book, The Last Investigation, one of the best, in my opinion. That was preceded with a November 1980 article in the Washingtonian magazine. And I was just going through some things, and I saw that, and I remembered that article, and I reread it, and I thought, you know, Gayton was fantastic, and I want to write about him, but I want to take a little different approach. And so I spent hours and hours on the phone with his wife, Marie, and the article, it's in three parts, in George Magazine and now in the JFK Files Volume 2. And it's a behind-the-scenes thing about Gayton. Like, she talks about when he got the call from Schweiker to get on staff and do some investigating. You know, they were standing in the kitchen, and Gayton hung up the phone, and he said, "I'm going to help solve the Kennedy assassination." And she said, and then we just danced around in the kitchen. And so, you know, just their relationship, what Gayton was like, very, very interesting stuff that I don't think anybody else has written about. I've also got an article in there with Joan Mellon, who talks about New Orleans and all that. An interview with Larry Boone, who is the son of Eugene Boone, and I learned that Eugene Boone didn't buy the official version. The Ricky and Tricia White story is in there about Roscoe White, and then there's several other interviews in there. So again, the book is you know, of the interviews I've done over the last couple of years, very little of the book is my opinion. I write these books and offer these stories and interviews for researchers to read, and hope that in some way they're helpful for others in their research. I got criticized once for, you know, not saying what I think or questioning what was said, which I do a little bit of. But the books, these interview books, the JFK Files, Volume 1 and 2, they're not about me. They're not about what I think. They're about what I learned. And I have them published in the hope that I can help others learn. So that Volume 2 is now available on Amazon.
Good. We'll make a link to that.
Okay.
All right. Is a website or a Facebook page that you have?
I don't do Facebook.
Okay. No problem.
Yeah. Maybe I should, but I don't. Too much garbage on there.
All right, then. We've been speaking to Jeff Meek. Thank you so much for writing, and keep up the good work. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Good talking with you again. Thank you.
All right. Okay, good. Bye-bye. Night.